Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich.
A warm welcome to our podcast series im Kunstraum, where we take a deeper look into the ideas and stories behind our program. Through conversations with artists, curators and thinkers, as well as behind-the-scenes insights into our exhibitions and events, we aim to bring our work a little closer to you, even when you can't be here in person. Today, I'm very happy to welcome you, dear Lorena Moreno-Vera. Hi.
Hi.
Lorena is an interdependent curator based in Vienna and Mexico City. Her work explores narratives of natural phenomena and physiological functions through feminist theory, philosophy of science, and traditional knowledge. An MA graduate in critical studies from the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna, she has collaborated with festivals and institutions across Mexico, Austria, Spain, Switzerland, and Australia, including Museo Jumex. Do I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, perfect.
Tangente St. Pölten and Museum of Old and New Art, MONA. She's also part of Las Chulas, a multidisciplinary collective focused on research, community, and environmental awareness. Thanks for making time, dear Lorena.
No, thank you for the invitation.
So last week we've opened the wonderful and truly poetic exhibition that you've created at the Kunstraum, Between the Tremor and a Murmur Lies a Sunset. And we want to use the next 40 minutes or so to zoom into the show's premise, its literal vibrations and reverberations and urgencies. And given that the senses and the act of listening take up such a vital part in this exhibition, I would like to approach it as such and start our conversation by asking you to describe what visitors can actually sense upon entering this show. Maybe we can start with that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the invitation. And just to give a bit of context, the exhibition takes a great deal of inspiration in David Abram's book, The Spell of the Senses. Abram is an ecologist and philosopher, also known for coining the term more than human, which is a realm that both contains humankind and yet also exceeds humankind and human culture as part of a commonwealth of earthly life. In Spell of the Senses, he describes the more-than-human world as an intimate terrain infused with birdsong, salt spray, and the light of stars. In short, Abram calls for a stronger engagement of the senses to enhance and regain this lost communication with the more-than-human world as part of this assumption of humans as outside of nature and subjecting it to their service. This is not the general view among humans, of course, but it gained popularity for the sake of progress powered by modernity in Western cultures mainly. So a sensuous space is thus an animate domain where perception, language, and certain magic converge through embodiment, reciprocity, and the interdependence of all life forms. So the exhibition is conceived, or divided if you may, in Songs of Earth and Fire at the very entrance. Then comes another section of word spells that call for synesthetic readings, and finally are the sea incantations.
Mm-hmm. And what sounds, what kind of noises and voices can we exactly perceive when we actually enter the space?
So at the very entrance, there are these pulsing sounds of the Etna and the Stromboli in dialogue with Pez, Elizabeth Gallon Droste, and Pablo Torres. There is Tania Candiani's video that it's a 10-minute long video. It's a video called For the Animals. Pablo's and Elizabeth's is very subtle and abstract, whereas Tania Candiani's is very narrative and it has a very marked plot to it, so to say. Also, in comparison to an apparently silent piece like Edgar Calel's Embroidery, which is acting kind of like a score, portraying these songs of the created by his late grandmother, but it's also this volcanic landscape that you see embroidered on the canvas. Mm-hmm. So then it also creates these like active and silent moments. Mm-hmm. And same goes with Orlas. You know, like you read them and then by the sentences that she's putting there, then once you repeat them in your head or if you murmur them or whatever, it's also like it has a very sonorous aspect to it.
Yeah. So Orla Berry's pieces both hang on the wall, or like the one that's a vinyl, basically. And the other one is made of felt, and it, you can actually read, frogs are female toads, right?
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. But there's one work, or two works left, maybe we just briefly touch upon them.
Yeah, so then it's the piece by Anca Venera and Arnold Estefan, which is called How to Mend a Broken Sea. It's a video installation, and I mean, we will go more into more detail, but it's a performer chanting these traditional Romanian chants that are like these spectral songs. And then lastly it's the piece by Niamh O'Malley, which is also silent, and it's called Sun. So for me, coming back to the idea of these different sonorous moments, it's I wanted to show Niamh's piece because it's like a reflection on these different moments throughout day and these different sonorous moments that we get to experience throughout the day because, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now we've already introduced each work very briefly, but and we will go more deeply into that indeed just a bit. But before we do so, I just wanted to sort of tie these utterances, these expressions to the very personal encounters and experience that you've had yourself since, I think, 2017, and which apparently also informed your thinking around this exhibition. And I was wondering if you mind laying them out a little bit and explain a little bit how exactly they fed into this show.
Sure. Well, I have been passionate about sound, I guess, since I was a kid. I realized that most of my memories place special emphasis on the acoustic aspects of the events I try to recall. For example, I was obsessed by the seismic alarm that was launched in the early 90s in Mexico. So I was so frightened by it, but I always sought to replicate it with my voice. Very weird.
So the seismic alarm would go off when there's...
Exactly.
An eruption?
For earthquakes. And you have 1 minute, 2 minutes to leave the premises or put yourself into a hopefully safe, safe space. So for the show, I focused, I focused on situations that surprised me, challenged me, or shook me to my very core. And they all involved a direct encounter with the more than human world. So after I received the invitation to curate a show at Kunstraum and heard this year's topic, it felt like a good way to articulate some ongoing conversations with some of the artists that are gathered here and related to these aspects that had been resonating in my head. So why not digging deeper there? So as I said, I'm from Mexico City, a wonderful place that challenges you every single day. it is this monster of a city with different terrains, from muddy to volcanic because of different geological and colonization aspects. It is also a valley, so you are surrounded by mountains, hills, and two volcanoes, the Popocatépetl and the Iztaccíhuatl. The Popo, short for Popocatépetl, because it's a freaking long name, is still active and has exhalations from time to time. Likewise, Mexico City is located in an area of high seismic activity where the Cocos Plate submerges beneath the North American Plate, causing earthquakes. So you're never bored. So in 2017, a mighty one hit the city, and it felt like running on quicksand. Although I heard the cracks, I remember it silent, a deaf silence. A friend of mine arrived at the time to the gallery where I was working. So he came by subway, so he experienced the earthquake on the ground. So when he came up to the surface, he saw a woman smacking the pavement of the sidewalk with her bare hand and yelling to the earth. An attempt to scold it, I guess. However, my friend didn't manage to hear the content of these shouts. He also remembered it silent, funny voice. So there were many collapses, many people perished, unfortunately. So many silences accompanied that loss. But at the same time, it's a very loud feeling that accompanies you all the time. The tremor of that relationship we hold with nature that is at once visceral and poetic. That power it has that makes you rethink your existence and shows you how fragile you are. On a happier note, last year I spent some time in Santander in the north of Spain, as well as part of a seminar titled Reading Ocean Imprints. We held conversations with all sorts of people, beekeepers, oceanographers, engineers, farmers, what have you. But one of the most impressive ones was Maximo, a topographer by trade, but a zoologist at heart. We walked along the Pasiego valleys as he was explaining us how to read animal imprints. Every description led to a very detailed story of badgers, deers, wolves, cows. Some were injured, some were on the hunt, some were fresh, some were smudged. Maximus' capacity for storytelling was remarkable. So we were saying that although, of course, these stories carried Maximus' knowledge and fine observations of the area, there was always a pinch of fiction to spice it up. And as Mackenzie Work says, there's always a bit of fiction in fact and a bit of fact in fiction. The best part was when he reproduced some bird songs and waited for the reply. Then he said, "Oh, I guess I made them angry." So to which we replied, "Well, what did you tell them?" So, and I could go on and on in this. So, like, a last experience that also informs this exhibition was that also I spent some time in Ireland last year. And I was surprised by once, like, the smell and the touch of humidity all over the place. Also of the powerful winds during a storm in Galway that surprisingly, while I very irresponsibly was walking towards Silver Strand, a beautiful beach close by, these same strong winds were contained by the forest because you had to cross the forest to reach the beach. So I sat and listened to the wind, but I could not feel not even one slight breeze. So this was really beautiful. Lastly, it was the seagulls mooing nonstop, except for the night, or at least it felt like. Sun rose quite late during that time, and I had thick blinds on all the windows of my studio. So at times I didn't know what time it was, except for the seagulls. The funniest part was that as I came back to Vienna during my first night, I was dreaming of them, the seagulls. And as I woke up, I was totally disoriented of where I was, mainly because of that deaf silence. So, yeah, there were no more mews to measure time.
So thank you very much for sharing these personal accounts of yours with us. I would like to go back to the individual works, and we've now sort of delved a little bit into their utterances, what they do on a sensual level with visitors. But maybe we could go a little bit into their contents, and maybe you could briefly describe, what each of these contributions actually do.
Sure. So, like, walk, like trying to guide you through the exhibition space. As one comes into the room, one encounters this installation we were talking about at the very beginning called I Build My Language with Rocks, Ash Rain, by the duo PES, which is Elizabeth Gallondroste and Pablo Torres Gomez. So it's a sound and basaltic rock installation. So it's a selection of basaltic stones hanging from the ceiling, held by threads connected to subwoofers. And the piece is guiding you to into the volcano, so in also to bring about these echoes of the Etna and the Stromboli, with very few or non intermission to it. I mean, an intermission, I mean, like from Pablo and Elizabeth. So it's very raw recordings from the volcano. So it's maybe just like some fine editing to the sounds. And they say that their first approach, or how they came to the idea of working with this archipelago, was through a dream. Like the volcano came to them through a dream. So then they decided to set themselves into this area and start doing this research, but also, I mean, about the volcanoes, but also of the inhabitants of the area. As we were also mentioning, they have activated this piece in different occasions as a radio, as a radio program, and like for the opening, it was a live performance with some synthesizers, and so that it can become also this contemplating moment of how a volcano could sound, if you may, without the fear of the eruption. No, just in the like in the comfort of an exhibition space. So then, if you turn to your right, there's a wall with one large embroidery by Edgar Calel that was also made in collaboration with his family. And the piece is called The Echo of My Spirit. So Edgar has this ongoing practice or project that it's called the Kit Kit Song. And it's this song that was created by his late grandma. And it's this onomatopoetic way to call the birds for feeding. So on one hand, it's also trying to make a connection between like an understanding of the chants of these birds and how could this be translated into one's own language. Mm-hmm. So how to actually establish some sort of conversation. So this song also has become kind of a tradition that has passed from generation to generation amongst Edgar's family relatives. So, and he has, again, just like Pablo and Elizabeth, he has also portrayed this song in different means and situations. So we started talking about like which possibilities could be, because they were like, either a mural or what. So then he decided like, no, why not doing it an embroidery, like a larger embroidery, so that we kind of mix these moments of conversation into one piece. Like the first layer is the Kit Kit Song, so it's also portraying this rooting aspect to it.
Mm-hmm. Just to illustrate that a little bit for our listeners, when you talk of layers, it's meant literally, you know? Like there are different layers within that embroidery.
Exactly. It's textile layers. Mm-hmm. So the first one is like the bottom part, and it's with this greenish thread. Mm-hmm. And then you see this Kit Kit Song written, more or less legibly. Then the second layer to it is taking some parts of the anatomy of a song, actually. So then it's again like, if you see it as a body, then it would be, I mean, first is the skin, then would be like muscles, again, mm-hmm. coming back to the idea of what he wanted to do for this piece, for anatomy of the song, like the muscles and the bones of of the song. And then the last layer, it's this a portrait of the highlands in Guatemala where he lives. So, and then a big aspect of it, it's the volcano. So also in this conversation we had in February, he said that volcanoes have two moments mainly, I mean several, but like they have a silent moment and then a very loud moment. So how can we transcribe these onto thread or drawing? So then you see it here with the gray bluish thread. It's the silent moment, whereas this red orange thread is the active moment of the volcano. So it's and he also says that these, whereas the other ones are the songs by the grandma or the birds and the roots. This is the song of the earth. Mm-hmm. So the embroidery works as a score of sorts. Mm-hmm. So if you move on, like to the back of the exhibition space, and then to the left, there is a video installation by Tania Candiani. The piece is called For the Animals, and it's a three-channel video, and it's also part of a larger body of work. So this piece stems from some lullabies that were written with Tania and in collaboration with another composer for animals of the Sonora Desert, that it's in Mexico and the US. So because the first time these body of works were exhibited were in Arizona. And it's important to mention this larger body of work because the piece, the video, also tries to bring back this synesthetic moment of the whole works, but also of what it means to be there and listening to this, to all these beings that are in this immensity and in this rather harsh ecosystem that it's the desert. So, but at the same time, she confronts us, to the skills that we have lost as humans. And also, like, there is a very, I mean, interesting phrase that she says, like, poor human range ear, no? So, because, and I have read also in other texts that, before we used to had a better auditory or like hearing sense, but we have lost it, of course, because of noise pollution and all the gadgets we have, have developed. And we have also passed these not only the hearing, but other tasks or skills onto other beings too, so that we could just delegate, so to say. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're also like disrupted and being quite co-opted by the quality of it. Likewise, she also takes phrases and some aspects of artists and scholars who have written extensively around sound, soundscapes, and so on, like Bernie Krause, Brandon LaBelle, Maura Schaefer, and so on. So it's like a very immersive moment to experience. So. And it's important to mention that it's a 10-minute piece and it has a 5-minute pause so that you can also get to listen to Pez's installation like in its entirety without other sort of dialogue. So if you're sitting there and you turn to your right, so you walk toward the end of the exhibition space of the place, and there are these two pieces by Orla Barry, and that are also part of a larger body of works called Breaking Rainbows. And here are, it's as Frederike mentioned, it's this felt piece called Frogs Are Female Toads. And then there is another print that it's working as a wallpaper of sorts, that it's Milk the EU. So both of the pieces are also connected to a QR code, so you can listen to these performative rehearsals that took place while the preparation of the videos and so on. But with Orla holds this dual work or dual role as a sheep farmer, because she has a sheep farm in Wexford in Ireland, and also as an artist. So as an artist, she has long been working with language and concrete poetry and so on. So, and she lived for a while in Belgium and in the Netherlands, so she distanced herself from this farm life, but then she came back to Ireland and took back the farm. And now, and there is a very nice phrase from her that she says, like, I escaped the farm at the studio, and I escaped the studio at the farm. But of course, it is visible that both practices inform the other. Mm-hmm. And it's also very interesting what she sets in these pieces, because on one hand, it's also bringing this bucolic life, but also set these critical aspects to it, because on one hand, it's like the notion of she being a woman in a farmer's world, mm-hmm. Which is quite tough. Because she also brings the sheep to contests and so on, but mm-hmm. then it's also like it's a very male predominant world. So, mm-hmm. like, how do you have to perform, you know? And on the other hand, being directly into this, drawn to these aspects of life and death that are at stake all the time. And also like this sort of collaboration with the sheep and understanding like what they need, how they function. And she has a name for each one of them. But it also understanding, there's a documentary about her work, which is really impressive. And then she says like, yeah, I also have to acknowledge that there are moments in which, you know, the expenses and so on, like I cannot cover them. So like also the amount of money one get for wool, it's not enough just by the practice of like shaving them. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, yeah, these sheep have to be sold for flesh, for meat. So it is this very painful moment in which like these, and she says these, like I have to give away these ladies who have given me so much. So it's also very painful. And but at the same time, she also makes this word plays and like frogs are female toads, that also kind of making fun of, and I include myself in this like city mouse lack of knowledge of of what happens at farm, and that we tend to romanticize it and say like, oh, it's so beautiful, it must be lovely to be there. Mm-hmm. So, and then she's always saying like, yeah, so people read like frogs are female toads, and then the next thing is like, are they? And so on. And then Milk the EU is taken by this,
which is the other piece, the print.
On
the
exactly. Mm-hmm. It's taken by writing by Virgil, in which sets these farmers contest, like song contest. So one is telling, he's mentioning this one, but it's funny that then she starts, I mean, it's a triangle, let's say, like the shape you see, it's a triangle. So you see like the defragmenting of the of this short sentence or short phrase, milk the ewe. Ewe is a female sheep, for those who couldn't know, because I also had to find out, I didn't know. So then it's breaking it down into a kind of a concrete poetry manner. And then ew is written E-W-E, but then she, because of the sound of it, she turns it into a E-U. So I thought it was on purpose to talk about the European Union, like milk, the European Union. And then she was like, no, I haven't thought of that. So it was really funny. But yeah, so for me, it's this very interesting aspect of spells. Because then coming back to David Abram's book, he's also talking about like the term of spell, like casting a spell, but also it's spelling a word. So by the correct pronunciation of or description of a word, it's also like you cast a spell onto it, no? Like you activate it. And then on that note, you move to the right, and there is this video room where Anka Benelos and Arnold Estefan's piece is called How to Mend the Broken Sea. So they managed to create this fabulous ambience. So the video is, as I mentioned before, it's a performer chanting this lullaby as an attempt to soothe the Black Sea. But at the same time, they're also talking about how, how turbulent the waters of the Black Sea are. But also, they create a very good parallelism to the conflictual area it is, because, so, and also, just by its nature, because the composition of the Black Sea gathers these two layers that never mix. One is of salty water and the other one is of sweet water. Like the sweet water comes because of the mouthing of different rivers, one of them being the Danube. But also at the bottom there is this abyss that creates this lack of oxygen layer. So actually they have also found lots of shipwrecks and like pieces, and because of that lack of oxygen they are remain intact. So at the bottom of the Black Sea there is some sort of museum, and they cannot just bring them out to the surface because they will perish. So it's really interesting, like how there's this, and also there's no life at the bottom of it. But in the first layer, there is life and there is like a whole other ecosystem going on. So this lack of mixture also creates these waters that are like quite harsh to navigate. And yeah, well, we know about these geopolitical conflicts that accompany this same turbulence of the waters. So that's why there's an attempt to soothe them, but at the same time to create a sort of union or gathering of all the identities that converge there. So these songs that Diana performs are taken from different parts of all the languages that converge in the area. So it's really beautiful to and really ecstatic to listen to this. And also, Anka and Arnold set a mirror floor, so that you also get to see these reflections as you would see in the waters. There are some pebbles and stones. Some are actually taken from the Danube. And there's an object that is a boy, but it also has these metal sticks to attached or welded to it. And you can see on the video that Diana is also playing it like if it would be a violin with a bow. So then you get to see the whole situation. And yeah, last but not least, once you come back to the main exhibition space towards the end of the front area, all the way to the left, there is the film by Niamh O'Malley, Sun. And it's this recording of the sun, like coming and going and fading. But also there is this sort of fog layer to it because it was recorded in Ireland. So as I was saying, for me, Niamh's piece becomes this sort of silent metronome to keep track of these different moments in during the day that ones get to experience these different acoustic moments. And next to it, we set this nice consulting space with some books so that you can also sit and enjoy the sun.
Thank you so much for this tour through the exhibition. I was wondering, while the communicative faculties of nature and its very subjectivity are central to your show, the human figure still recurs in some of the works where it is at least implicated, even if not visually. Would you mind describing how they... how so, and how being a human on this planet is approached in your exhibition?
Yeah, well, all the works are human-made and stem from that perspective. In some cases, it is a dialogue, like with Pes and the volcanic pulsations of the Etna and the Stromboli taking over the entrance of the Kunstraum. The piece also refers to the pulses they experienced while they were at the volcano and how their human bodies got permeated by the volcano, because volcanoes have these strong magnetic forces. So they were telling me that as they were there and they spent more time there, they realized how this magnetism influenced their human bodies, like liquids and the metals that we hold. So then they started feeling this sort of, like disruptions of sorts. So it is really interesting how like one body penetrates this human body, no? And how you get to experience it and like transmit from that. There are these other narrative aspects, like with Edgar Calel, where the thread needs and outlines that relation to the highlands, but also to the family and roots. With Orla, it comes from this dual profession, as I was saying, and the vision of hers. So as a farmer and as an artist. So she works with sheep and deals with all what these beings entail. So life, dead, meat, flesh, threads, because then they're like, she was also telling me that when it's the lambing season, then there are lots of foxes and crows, ravens that are like hunting the little lambs. So there's also these wool, bleats and yells that are at stake. So all these elements build a vocabulary, and she's an expert to put them at play. Mm-hmm. And we can get to see a glimpse of this in, mm-hmm. with these two pieces. So with Anke and Arnold, they did it through the powerful spectral chants of Diana Miron and the roars of the Black Sea. So it's a poetic way to try to soothe this body of water, but also sing out loud the turbulence of the area. With Tanya, she confronts us directly with our human condition, that it's part of this sonar and family score, despite our limited skills. As I was saying, and she mentions it during the video, our poor human range hearing. And in relation to these restrictions, Neef masters this beautiful and subtle piece as an attempt to record the sun while emphasizing the real impossibility we have of looking directly at it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one other thing that I got really curious about is the notion of time and also the different temporal cycles that traverse your exhibition as well. And you just mentioned also Neef's work, like the recording of the sun. And the sun itself is indeed a real rhythm maker of our everyday life. And you also just outlined before how also you've been, your sense of time has been influenced so much by natural phenomena, like animals, like the sun, or and so on. But in your show, we are also confronted with deep time. So walking through the exhibition myself, I had this realization, for instance, that all these forms of communication and rhythm-making entities have indeed existed long before our species started life on this very planet and have long communicated with each other. Mm. So as humans, we're just really late to the party, if you will, and still don't really get what's going on around us. And in a way, this creates perhaps a hierarchy, and perhaps that is also inscribed in the very term more than human that you've brought to the table in the very beginning of our conversation. It creates a fundamental counterimage to this modern narrative of the human, and we should add the white European human who is capable of controlling nature. But in a way, I also sense that you're not interested in these hierarchies, if I'm correct. maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah. No, I've never been interested in hierarchies. But, so for me, it's interesting to think beyond human notions of time, you know? And even within human notions of time, there is much more than just Greenwich. So that's why, I mean, coming back to it, that's why Neef O'Malley's piece became so important for me. Because it's like Neef tried to capture this ubiquitous body that rules life as we know it, and also give us this notion of time passing, whatever it is. So this act of filming the sun also highlighted this paradoxical impossibility of looking at it directly, even though we feel and see its presence all the time. But of course, this same sun is experienced in many other ways. So think of nocturnal animals or the fish in the abyssal area, in the abyssal zones. It's like a complete different notion of it. Like they are actually, I mean, for some, they are waiting for the sun to go down. Whereas like in the abyssal area, abyssal zones, you just see a very dim or none of it, mm-hmm. you know, but still there is a cycle of life or to life. Likewise, this track of time, I think of what it means for a mayfly, you know, these very small insects that get to live a day or two. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And on the opposite side, there is this Greenland shark that lives 400 years. So coming back to these hierarchies, that's why I also like to set this speculative exercise, if you may, like how would other species perceive notions of time? I know that we have to do it from the human perspective, but precisely because of that could be interesting. As I said, like, I mean, if you just have one day to live, what would you do? But also knowing these orchestras and timings in the modern human world, for example, I was talking with this artist based here in Vienna, Paula Flores. She's from Tijuana, and she was telling me that during the breeding season of gray whales in Baja California, it's a spectacular view because on one hand, like, of course, like the gray whales are beautiful beings, but also there is some sort of tacit agreement in which, like, while this period of breeding is happening, sharks and other species don't come into the bay area. So, and we were saying, like, but when did this agreement happen? No, like, it's really interesting, like, how this, I mean, I'm very naive, I'm not a biologist or whatever, unfortunately, but it's really interesting, like, how there are these orchestrating moments in nature. And also, well, for humans, there are some cultures that still respect or have respect for these cycles and know how to read when to harvest, when to let it rest, or what to harvest. So an example that comes to mind are the female divers in Korea, that they do this free diving and they go so deep as into 10 meters under the sea to gather the shellfish among other species without the help of any oxygen masks. So with a vast knowledge of this marine life and its cycles, they don't over-harvest. So they respect the seasons for each species, and they also make a unique whistle when resurfacing. And it's a technique to expel carbon dioxide from their lungs and to alert one another of the presence. So this is also quite interesting. And these sort of practice, I mean, these practices and the profound knowledge they hold has helped to promote environmental sustainability, but also they have aided to remove waste in the waters and so on. So I think it all comes down to attention and listening of the surroundings. And borrowing a closing note from Tania Candiani's video again, she's like, to be welcome in the acoustic harmony of the wild, a revelation of the planet's deeply connected expression of natural sounds and rhythm. Imagining a story where every word we speak was born at some point from this collective voice.
Speaking of listening, I was wondering, because with declining media attention for the ecological crisis and the global rise of fascism and the popularity of politicians that, for instance, identify new economic and strategic opportunities in the melting of Greenland's ice sheets, I was thinking, do you think that perhaps the problem may perhaps lay less in the listening and more in the interpretation of what nature's got to say?
Yeah, well, of course, because of interpretation can be instrumentalized or weaponized. And I was thinking of an essay by Alexander Galloway, in which the essay is called "Are Some Things Unrepresentable?" And then he's talking about information and data. So, but it's very interesting because there is an aspect that he breaks down data and information and takes it to the etymologies. By the way, I'm a very huge fan of etymology. So information stems from the Latin for the act of taking form or being put into form, in formare. Mm-hmm. So information stresses a plastic adoption of shape. Information exists whenever worldly things are informed or put into form. So it is the act of giving form to the data, of organizing it into a comprehensible or instrumentalized narrative by appealing to the plasticity intrinsic in its practice. So, of course, like these interpretations can be manipulated according to the agenda of the person power, which can be very risky. So for me, like listening and critical listening is key. Mm-hmm. And I was also thinking about like during the book presentation of of Brandon LaBelle's latest book, which is now here. He mentioned a quote by Simone Weil. It says, "Attention is the purest form of generosity." So listening is a relational act and goes beyond the ear, actually. It demands action too. So to create spaces to claim the right to speak, but also, as I was saying, like to rustle, to hold, to roar, to erupt, but also to, we have to create spaces that grant the right to be heard and mm-hmm. to be protected. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, sometimes I am amazed of how humans are the only species that plots its own extinction. So, Baldi said. And while I was thinking about this question, I was also thinking about the statement of the Global Commons. So maybe it would be worthwhile bringing up one of the criteria for a resource to be considered a Global Commons. Is that the effects of use, management, or abuse, mismanagement of the domain are experienced universally. So in this sense, questions around listening, community, and planetary entanglements feel more vital than ever.
You already mentioned David Abram's book and then Brandon LaBelle's literature, but you also brought other books for the book corner in the exhibition. Could you briefly list them and let us know what they're briefly about?
Yeah. For example, there are two books by Vincent Despret. And Vincent Despret is a philosopher, a Belgian philosopher of science. And my first encounter with her was through a lecture she gave for the Riga Biennial. So, and then, I mean, she has written extensively about birds. And during this lecture, she talks about the performativity of birds in order to, like, also claim territory. But at times, they're also, like, co-inhabiting situations and who shows what colors or feathers and so on. So, and also how these chirps or these songs change depending on season. And then during this lecture, she brings or takes one book, which is beautiful and I couldn't recommend it enough, by Italo Calvino, that it's also here, called Mr. Palomar. So Mr. Palomar is this guy who observes different situations in order to explain himself, like existence. So the book is divided into different episodes, and one of them it's about the how's it in English, blackbird. Mm-hmm. So he's like keeping record of the blackbird on his in his garden, and about this because the song of the blackbird, it's quite, how do you say it? I mean, it's not constant. It has like, and then there is like huge pauses and then continues. So then like he starts to wonder, where does the message from in the Blackbird song lie? Like, is it during the chant, like the sonorous moment, or is it actually in the pauses? So this really blew my mind, like because yeah, and coming back to what I was talking about, Maximo and so on, like, of course, with ornithologists, biologists and so on, there is a huge amount of observation and experimentation and facts, but there has to be some aspect of fiction to it, you know, like an or speculation of how it actually happens. And also there is one book by Vinciane Desprez, that is the last one she published, called The Autobiography of an Octopus. So it's also several stories, being the last one, The Autobiography of the Octopus, and it's talking about these beings, or these kind of children called the Ulysse, and they are trained to listen, to learn the language of water and of octopuses. So it's really interesting, because then there is a scientist that it's spending time with one of the Ulysse, and then this Ulysse is trying to explain her and also challenging her, like that what she needs to unlearn to learn this language. So it's really beautiful how she writes it. And yeah, so there are like other, there is one that it's printed, like a digital print of a text, one of the many essays of Ursula K. Le Guin. And then there is an aspect to it that she's talking about how originally we were meant to read out loud, because it was a gathering situation. So, and then like by reading out loud, then it was also like taking part of the story and like impersonating the story. And whereas now we are doing it in silence, and then it takes you onto a complete different
solitude.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then there is another book by Valeria Luiselli. It's a Mexican writer. So it's funny, I mean, for me, the interesting part of this book, well, first is the title, because in Spanish it's called Desierto Sonoro, like Sonorous Desert, whereas in English it's like The Archive of the Children or something like that, I don't remember. And then, like, I wrote it in Spanish, of course, but actually I realized that she wrote them originally, she wrote it originally in English. Because and the translation is also done by herself, so it is the story of this patchwork family along the border between Mexico and the U.S. that starts because of the of two different research points from the. Like the woman and the man, because this woman who has a kid, then she starts researching about all the languages that are registered or spoken in New York. And then from there, she comes to, with she approaches this story of this woman who was originally from Oaxaca, Mexico, and she crossed the border to the U.S., but left behind two daughters. And then she was longing for these daughters to join her, but as you might know, it's not always easy. So then they were caught in the middle of the border and so on. So then this researcher sets herself onto the, I mean, onto the journey to discover all these aspects of border crossing, but all of it is through sound. And at the same time, the partner is looking for this heritage of this Sioux warrior called Hieronymus. So, but it's also done through sound. Mm-hmm. In parallel to it, both of the children of each that are also joining the trip, they are collecting music and different elements to it. So then it's a very interesting way, like how to narrate it and then how to make an archive of sound and music during this journey.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much for these recommendations of books. I think we are all equipped with plenty of food for thought. And thank you so much for your time. And I warmly recommend you, dear listeners, to come visit us at the Kunstraum. Thank you.
Thank you.